Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
From the inside pages of the Odessa American, Wednesday, October 12th. Meth seized during traffic stop. A routine traffic stop led to the arrest Friday night of an Odessa woman and the seizure of 126 grams of methamphetamine. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers pulled over a Dodge Ram pickup near West County Road and the Interstate 20 Service Road when the driver, Daniela Angelica Guillen Orta, 32, failed to stop at the proper place at a traffic control device. Officers had information Orta distributed narcotics and had a canine officer search the car. After the dog alerted to the presence of drugs, Orta told officers she had a meth pipe in her purse. But during a subsequent search, officers found the pipe and 5 grams of meth in her purse. They also found 121.2 grams of meth in the back passenger door pocket, the report stated. Orta was arrested on suspicion of manufacturing or delivery of a controlled substance, 4 grams to 200 grams, and possession of a controlled substance, 1 grams to 4 grams. The manufacturing charge is a first-degree felony punishable by 5 years to life in prison, and the possession charge is a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Orta remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on an Immigrations and Customs Enforcement hold and surety bonds totaling $75,000. Odessan arrested following theft. Ector County Sheriff's Office deputies arrested a local man recently after seeing him walking down the road carrying aluminum wire moments after getting a theft in progress call. According to an ECSO report, deputies received a 911 call from AAL Investments on 68th Street on September 27th, and the caller told them a man wearing a red T-shirt had just taken aluminum wire from the property. Deputies spotted Skyler Don Conklin, who was wearing a red T-shirt, walking on Judy Street and carrying aluminum wire, the report stated. Conklin, 27, was caught on video and photographed while putting the wire over the fence at AAL Investments, according to the report. Conklin was arrested on suspicion of theft of material under $20,000. He remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on a $5,000 surety bond. Two arrested following undercover sting. Two men are facing a solicitation of prostitution charge after being caught up in a recent Texas Department of Public Safety undercover operation. According to DPS reports, Casey Brent Valenueva, 30, and Angel Robles, 27, both responded via text message to an online advertisement for prostitution on September 27th and engaged in separate text conversations with an undercover police officer. During the course of the conversation, both men agreed to pay specific amounts for sex acts and showed up at the hotel room where they expected the sex acts to occur, the report stated. Villanueva and Robles were arrested on suspicion of solicitation of prostitution, a state jail felony punishable by 6 months to 2 years in prison. Both men were released from the Ector County Jail after paying surety bonds of $5,000 each. UTPB delays engineering accreditation by Ruth Campbell. UTPB has pushed its accreditation board for engineering and technology timeline to 2024 to maximize its chances for success, and President Sandra Woodley and Dean of College of Engineering George Nana met with 30 to 40 chemical and electrical engineering students Monday to discuss the situation. But students were still confused and concerned after that meeting. "When I met with the students," Woodley said, "we explained to them that the original plan was to go for ABET accreditation in the fall of 23. Of course, you already know we're accredited through SACS-COC, Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, Commission on Colleges. So our primary accreditation is in place. ABET accreditation is an extra piece that we care about and want to pursue, but it's important to pursue it at a time when we have the highest probability of success. So we had some experts and others take a look at the program, and I made a determination that our best chance of success was to give ourselves one more year on the electrical and the chemical before we go up for ABET accreditation," Woodley said. There's no downside to waiting 1 year other than the fact that it takes a little bit longer. The students who are in the pipeline to graduate within a 2-year window will automatically be grandfathered into that ABET designation. So even under the revised timeline, all students will have that designation if we're successful at securing it, Woodley said, noting that 7 students graduated last spring and are currently working. We will pull them in as well through a waiver process that reissues their degrees so long as the curriculum stays the same over the 2 years, she said. The bottom line is this 1-year delay gives us our best chance at success at securing the ABET accreditation, and it does not impact the students at all. They will all be grandfathered in or pulled in through a waiver. SACS accreditation, the accreditation we currently have, allows them to sit for their licensing exam. All of the licensure exams, the fundamentals of engineering that you're able to sit for with SACS accreditation, you don't need ABET accreditation for that, Woodley said. The accreditation process takes 12 to 18 months and includes 8 criteria. Students said that professors knew in advance that the timeline had been delayed. I think the decision to push it back has only happened in the last couple of months as we've been reviewing everything. The faculty, like the students, would like it to happen on the original timeline, and I wish it could happen on the original timeline too. I just think it's not worth the risk of not being successful with ABET accreditation, Woodley added. She said the mechanical and petroleum engineering are up for ABET accreditation. So that will go on as scheduled, Woodley said. Between now and the next 6 months, we'll be taking the original plan for chemical and electrical and updating that. We'll get some extra consultant help to figure out what we need to do to give ourselves the best chance to be successful, and then we'll work toward the success in fall of 2024, Woodley said. Not getting into specifics, she said there were several pieces in the 8 criteria where they thought they might have some weaknesses based on expert evaluation and internal analysis. We need to make sure that we have enough resources and have the right faculty in place, Woodley said. There are student components on the success of the students and how they're doing. I think we're in relatively good shape, but not optimally yet. So we want to take all 8 criteria and make sure we can shore up any potential deficiencies. She added that it's understandable that there is disappointment, but I think it's also really important to continue to evaluate and reevaluate so we don't impact the students in the same program negatively. We think we'll be in much better shape a year from now, Woodley said. She said it was important to note that the 7 graduates from last spring all have jobs in the Permian Basin.
In the obituaries, we have first Ray Ratliff Hurt. James Ratliff Hurt Jr. from Midland was born on November 4, 1953. He was born and raised on the family ranch in Odessa. Jay loved nothing more than the life of a rancher. He attended Austin Elementary and Crockett Junior High, where he met his wife of 49 years, Vicki Carol Thomas. Jay and Vicki graduated from Odessa High School in 1972 and were married in 1973. Jay is preceded in death by his grandparents, Sam Hurt and Mary Hurt McCullum, and Pete and Helen Wheeler, his in-laws, A.C. Thomas and Norma Jean Johnson Bryce, and his nephew, Ben Heap. He is survived by his wife, Vicki Carol Thomas Hurt, his parents, James R. Buzz Hurt and Betsy Tiplett Hurt, and Freddie Jean Wheeler. Jay had many siblings, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews, and a vast amount of extended family and friends. Lori Grizzard of Midland, Texas, passed away Friday, October 7, 2022, in Midland, Texas, at the age of 60. Lori was born April 14, 1962, in Lubbock, Texas. She graduated from Permian High School, and she attended Odessa College. In Big Spring, Kenneth Ray Bowen, 81, of Odessa, died Monday, October 10th, in Big Spring. Bob Wayne Dutton of Midland was 75 years of age and passed away on Saturday, October the 8th. A celebration of life will be held on Friday, October the 14th at 2 p.m. at First Methodist Church in Midland. He was born in Borger, Texas on March 12, 1947. He attended Borger High School and graduated from Texas Tech University. Bob served in the U.S. Army as a Vietnamese linguist. He was attached to the 101st Airborne in Vietnam. In 1978, Bob opened Bob Dutton CPA. As the firm grew, it became Dutton Harrison Company, employing over 30 people. Bob is survived by his wife of 54 years, Letty Dutton, Johnny Lavario Gochicoa, G-O-C-H-I-C-O-A, 76 of Odessa, died Thursday, October 6th in Lubbock. Betty Jewel Slaughter York of Rodoso died Saturday, October the 8th at the age of 88. Brigadier General Bob L. Mitchell, retired, 86, died Friday, October the 7th, surrounded by his loving family. Bob spent most of his childhood in Odessa, Texas, and graduated from Odessa High School in 1955. He earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in mathematics from Hardin-Simmons University in 1959 and a Master of Science in Systems Management from the University of Southern California in 1971. After graduating from officer training school in 1963, he entered pilot training and received his wings at Williams Air Force Base in Arizona in 1965. During his 30-year career in the U.S. Air Force, he flew C-130 transport planes, was in Space and Missile Systems Command, and flew rescue and recovery helicopters in Vietnam. His distinguished career included commander of the 41st Tactical Airlift Squadron of Pope Air Force Base, North Carolina, wing commander of the 375th Aero Medical Airlift Wing, Scott Air Force Base, Illinois. Three tours of duty at the Pentagon and culminated as wing commander of the 89th Military Airlift Wing at Andrews Air Force Base, Maryland. He received many awards, including numerous meritorious service medals, the Bronze Star, the Distinguished Flying Cross, and the Legion of Merit. Bob is survived by his devoted wife of 62 years, Molly Jackson Mitchell, his daughters and their husbands, and five adoring grandchildren. Jimmy Harold Jones of Odessa passed from this life peacefully at his home, surrounded by his loving family, on Sunday, October the 9th. He was born February the 8th, 1935, in Dublin, Texas. Jimmy attended high school in Cisco, Texas, and graduated from Cisco Junior College with a B.S. in elementary education and obtained his Master of Education at East Texas State University. In 1960, he served in the U.S. Air Force and was medically discharged in 1955. Jimmy is survived by his wife, Lydia Jones, his son, two daughters, their husbands, and three grandchildren. Daryl Glenn Williamson of Odessa passed from this life into eternity on October the 8th after a relatively short illness. He was an avid saxophone player at the Emmanuel Baptist Church and with the OC Jazz Band, although he was a firefighter for 24 years and the owner of an irrigation company. His most important life work was encouraging others to live for Christ. He is survived by wife Patty Williamson, his daughters and son and their spouses, his grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness for Wednesday, October 12th, 2022. MMH earns sleep program accreditation. The Midland Memorial Hospital Diagnostic Sleep Center recently received program accreditation from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Quote, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine congratulates Midland Memorial Hospital on meeting the high standards required to earn accreditation as a sleep disorders center, end quote, said Dr. Jennifer Martin, AASM president. Quote, Midland Memorial Hospital is an important resource for the local community and will provide the highest quality care for people who have sleep disorders. Sleep is essential to health, and the effective treatment of sleep disorders can be life-changing, end quote. To receive and maintain accreditation for a five-year period, a sleep center must meet or exceed all standards for professional health care as designated by the AASM. These standards address core areas such as personnel, facility and equipment, policies and procedures, data acquisition, patient care, and quality assurance. Additionally, the sleep center's goals must be clearly stated and include plans for positively affecting the quality of medical care in the community it serves. Quote, the Diagnostic Sleep Center of Midland is proud of our physicians and staff for the dedication to providing high-quality sleep care for Greater Midland, end quote, said Sean Stark, cardiopulmonary and neurology diagnostics manager. Quote, sleep is an important pillar to helping us fulfill our vision of becoming the healthiest community in Texas, end quote. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine accredited a sleep disorders center for the first time in 1977. Today, there are more than 2,600 AASM-accredited sleep centers across the country. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine is a professional medical society for clinicians, researchers, and other healthcare providers in the field of sleep medicine. As the national accrediting body for sleep disorders centers, the AASM improves sleep health and promotes high-quality patient-centered care through advocacy, education, strategic research, and practice standards. Learn about depression fallacies. In my work as a therapist, there is one particular misconception about depression I have encountered frequently that I believe everyone can benefit from learning about, regardless of whether you have depression. First off, let's make sure everyone knows that when I refer to depression, I'm speaking of a mood state that can be present in a few different diagnosable mental health disorders. Depression has several potential symptoms, and it looks different in everyone, which I'm sure is not surprising. The big question I want to talk about is, how long does depression last? I have clients come in and tell me that, right now, they're doing well. They're not stuck in bed, and they're able to be productive, so they must have never really been depressed in the first place. Or clients tell me they've felt depressed a lot, but there are times when they don't, and so their family and friends believe they're faking it, or just being lazy when claiming to be depressed. I'm sure that some people do fake it, and there are probably many factors contributing to that. However, I want everyone to know that depression often isn't constant. It's typical for someone to be depressed for a period of time and then to feel better for a period of time. In major depressive disorder is what we call a depressive episode. To be recognized as a depressive episode, the period of depressed mood or loss of interest in things that used to be enjoyed lasts at least 2 weeks. A depressive episode can last much longer, but it may only last 2 weeks before someone starts feeling better. During a depressive episode, people struggle to maintain their daily lives at home, school, work, with friends, or in other areas. When symptoms go away or become less noticeable, this is called remission. Some people will only experience one episode of depression in their lives, and others will experience more than one episode. A second episode may look the same as the first, or it may have different symptoms. Based on the symptoms, episodes may be diagnosed as mild, moderate, or severe, and this can also vary between episodes. If someone experiences depression that does not go away for a long time, at least 2 years, or they have several episodes of depression over the course of 2 years or more, that person may have a type of depression called persistent depressive disorder. So, should someone come to counseling if they experienced a depressive episode but do not have symptoms now? Yes, absolutely. This can be a great time to identify and address any factors that may have contributed to causing the depressive episode, such as stress, history of trauma, or biological issues like chemical imbalances in the brain that may be best treated with medication. This can also be a time to learn coping skills and prepare for what to do if another depressive episode ever happens. Why is 2 weeks necessary to be called a depressive episode? It's normal for everyone to go through periods of time of feeling a depressed mood or losing interest in things or having other symptoms. We all experience times of stress or major changes in our lives that take a little time to adjust. If you get down for a little while, it's likely you don't have depression. Only about 2% of the population in the United States will have a depressive disorder. A lot of research has gone into defining the timeline and symptoms of depression. Clinical depression affecting a person's ability to function in daily life for an extended period of time will be a pattern recognized over that 2 week or longer period of time. If it has been less than 2 weeks, that does not mean someone does not have depression, but a counselor will want to monitor the duration of the symptoms and how they impact a person's daily life to make sure something other than depression, such as normal stress or another mental health disorder, isn't what really needs to be helped with. Just like going to a doctor and finding out that you're not ill, you may go to a counselor and find out that you're not ill and it's normal to feel what you're feeling in your circumstances. A counselor can still help you get through that and learn new ways of coping with normal parts of life that affect us all. I always caution against trying to diagnose yourself, whether with a physical condition or a mental health condition, but it is good to be aware of changes in yourself that don't feel right and what they might mean. It's never a bad thing to get checked out by an expert. And if you know someone you think might be struggling with their mental health, it's good to encourage them to get checked out too. Don't let misunderstanding what a mental health disorder looks like stop you from supporting someone you love or letting an expert help you out. Younger women impacted by breast cancer. Throughout my time as a breast cancer nurse navigator at the Breast Center in Midland, I have realized one common theme with breast cancer. It does not discriminate regarding age. Throughout my time in this position, I have assisted and guided patients from the ages of 21 to 90. Statistically speaking, women are much more prone to develop breast cancer at an older age. So, how is it that younger women are also experiencing this dreadful diagnosis? The truth of the matter is that breast cancer affects women of all ages. Younger women with breast cancer commonly face chemotherapy-induced menopause, decreased sexual function, infertility, diminished body image, as well as other side effects. Because of this, doing regular self-exams and screenings is even more important, as is being an advocate for yourself, even if it means doing so with your primary care provider or whatever physician you are seeing. Recently, a younger-aged woman told me she found a lump on her breast and proceeded to see her general physician. Her physician told her it was likely a cyst or a lipoma. In this particular case, had she not advocated for herself, her cancer would have gone undiagnosed. She requested an ultrasound just to be safe, which led to a biopsy for sampling, and unfortunately, the dreaded breast cancer diagnosis. Jen Johnson strongly encourages women to know their own breasts. Quote, do your monthly self-checks and don't be afraid to ask for help if you need it, end quote, Johnson said. Quote, there is never any shame with being proactive with your health, end quote. Younger women in the Permian Basin should feel encouraged to know Midland has what we have labeled as a young support group. The need for this group stemmed from so many more women receiving a breast cancer diagnosis at a younger age. This group provides psychosocial support, education, and symptom management. In addition, all the women that are part of this group have been affected by breast cancer in some way, shape, or form. Being supported by other young women that have walked your walk can be a very encouraging and empowering thing during such a trying time. Quote, the support group has helped me in ways I never knew I needed, end quote, Johnson said. Quote, no two journeys are exactly the same, but these women truly understand me and relate to each step that I am going through, end quote. As we all know, medical guidelines are never changing and not the same everywhere you go. The Midland Breast Center follows the American College of Radiology guidelines. Thus, a mammogram is recommended at age 40 unless a close relative has been diagnosed with breast cancer. If this is the case, we recommend you get your first mammogram 10 years before the age of the diagnosis. Also, if your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer greater than 20% because of personal and family history, breast screenings should start earlier. Just this calendar year of 2022 in Midland, we have diagnosed 8 ladies aged 30 to 39. We have also diagnosed 15 ladies aged 40 to 49. Thus, 20% of the ladies that we have diagnosed in 2022 have been under 50 years of age. It is so important to know your body. Do monthly breast self-exams, start screenings early if appropriate, and advocate for your health.
Spinal stenosis with lower back pains. Dear Dr. Roach, I am an extremely active 79-year-old woman. For at least 10 years, I have had lower back pain. I assumed it was arthritis and ignored it. By June, after an extremely tough exercise class, the intermittent pain became permanent. I called my orthopedic medical practice for an evaluation. The staff took x-rays and later told me that I must have had a fall in the past. I said that I had had one about 10 years ago. They immediately referred me to a pain management spinal physician. All the pain is left-sided, mostly from the lower back and butt area, and sometimes in the knee and leg areas. The worst is the sharp searing pain in the back. Going from a seated position to standing is extremely painful and sometimes takes my breath away. Once up, my right leg leads the way and I can walk for a good amount of time. Standing, though, for any amount of time can be painful. I am taking gabapentin every night to sleep. I take nothing during the day. I cannot do daily activities. I saw this new doctor who said he needed an MRI to make a better judgment. The MRI showed a compression deformity of the L4 vertebral body with spinal stenosis at L3 and 4 and L5 to S1. Is this awful pain permanent? Can I never go on walks or bike again? Can anything be done about this? Dr. Roach's reply. There are two issues here. The first is the compression of your L4 vertebrae. L stands for lumbar, which is the lowest part of your back below the thoracic chest vertebrae, but above the fused bones of the sacrum where the buttocks begin. That can happen with significant trauma that may also be due to osteoporosis. If that's really about 10 years old, it probably doesn't have to do with the recent worsening of your pain. Your back expert should comment on this.
This is the Dear Abby column. Husband refuses to confront friend who assaulted wife. Dear Abby, my husband's best friend groped my private several years ago at a party. It was traumatizing. I have never forgotten how abused and dirty it made me feel. I told my husband about it when we got home, but he'd had a lot to drink and told me I must have been imagining things. As time went by, I would occasionally bring it up, especially when we would see this person. When the hashtag MeToo movement came into being, it brought out all those memories, and I asked my husband to confront the man, who remains his best friend. He refuses. I am deeply hurt that he still thinks I'm imagining things and doesn't have my back. What should I do? Should I drop it or give him an ultimatum? Either confront the friend or I leave. Signed, Torn in Texas. Dear Torn, your husband doesn't think you are imagining things. For him to make that accusation is called gaslighting. He prefers to avoid a confrontation with his best friend rather than defend you because the friendship is more important to him than your feelings. From where I sit, that doesn't make your husband much of a man. Men who love their wives do not sit by silently when they have been disrespected. You might benefit from counseling to get beyond this. Has it occurred to you that you should speak up and demand an apology from the friend? If you were being serious when you stated that if your husband won't confront this person, you will leave him, allow me to offer a word of caution. Do not issue an ultimatum upon which you are not prepared to follow through. Dear Abby, I have been married to a wonderful woman for 29 years. We have two grown children, we are best friends, and our life together has been great. Abby, about 10 years ago, I realized I was gay. At first, I tried to ignore my feelings and concentrate on the commitment I had made to my wife and family. For a while, this worked well. However, my feelings for men grew stronger, and trying to hide from my true self became much harder. Now, I can't stop thinking about being with a man. I have even signed up for a dating site and flirted with a few men, although I have never met any of them in person, because I don't want to cheat on my wife. I don't know if I should tell her I'm gay and want to date men, or if I should continue suppressing my feelings for the sake of the family. Please help. Signed, Conflicted in California. Dear Conflicted, you stated that you and your wife are best friends. You aren't the only person who realized later in life that you were gay and knew you had to be true to yourself. The time has come to tell her everything. She may or may not even be shocked by the revelation, but she needs to know. How you both decide to handle this going forward is something only the two of you can work out. You could write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.